evening, three high school jazz ensembles will take the stage. The Thursday and Friday evening performances are the only ones that require tickets. They're available on Parkside's website. Just ahead of Greg Berg's morning show, let's check the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Lovely day today, sunny, windy, and warm, a high of 67. Warm southwest winds, 10 to 20 miles per hour. Right now, sunny, 40 in Kenosha, 39 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This song is the Dropkick Murphy classic Shipping Up to Boston, as arranged and performed by an amazing musical duo, Mia X Alley, two spectacularly gifted young musicians. Mia is violinist Mia Asano, who specializes in the electric violin. Alley refers to Alley Crowley Duncan, who bills herself as Alley the Piper, who plays an array of instruments, but her specialty, the bagpipes. The two of them joined forces in the spring of 2022 and have been creating a sensation ever since with their performances all across the country. Their current viral hits tour takes them to Milwaukee this Sunday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, for an 8 p.m. performance at the Vivarium, which is at 1818 North Farwell in Milwaukee. Before I go any further, I want to be sure to acknowledge the help of a good friend to the morning show, Jim McClure, who helped first turn me on to this amazing duo and helped me connect with them Jim saw them perform in Stoughton not long ago and was absolutely blown away. So I appreciate Jim's help in making the following interview possible with violinist Mia Asano and bagpiper Ali the Piper, who together form Mia X Ali. We welcome both of you to the morning show.
Hi. How's it going?
Great, and it's great to be talking with you. I'm excited to be able to find out a little more about your intriguing musical partnership and what people can expect if they turn out for your concert coming up, your performance on March 17th. Let's begin alphabetically with Mia Asano, if you don't mind, the violinist of this duo. Mia Asano, tell us a little bit about where you come from originally and kind of your love affair with the violin, where that began.
Well, I started playing violin when I was 5 years old. I was given the option between violin, piano, and guitar, and I chose right. And so I started playing classical music, and I did that for maybe 10 years before I finally discovered alternative styles of music, electric violin. And I just became obsessed with the electric violin as a concept, started playing, you know, pop, rock, Celtic, bluegrass, jazz, like anything I could get my hands on, really. And then graduated from the Denver School of the Arts. I'm originally from Colorado, and then moved to Boston for school, where I went to the Berklee College of Music. And, you know, being in Colorado really set me up for Berklee, because I was playing in, like, bluegrass bands, Viking rock bands. I was playing at fashion shows and just really honing my performance skills. So then by the time I got to college, I really wanted to pursue just contemporary violin. And so I started posting online during the pandemic because everything was shut down, and things went viral, and that's how I met Ali. More on that later.
Right. So two viral artists meeting together and collaborating. Ali, I'm very anxious to hear about your musical background as well, and if you were playing other things before the bagpipes took hold of your life, or from the start, has that been the primary focus of your musical efforts?
I definitely started playing musical instruments long before the bagpipe. My first instrument ever was piano. I started when I was about 6 years old, and I just fell in love with it. I just wanted to make noise the whole time. My mom tells everybody that I was singing before I could talk, and music was definitely my biggest coping mechanism as a little one. So I started piano, and then I cycled through woodwinds in school, and I played in every ensemble I could get my hands on. I still play the classic woodwind trio of clarinet, saxophone, and flutes, and I love them very much. And then when I was 12, actually, my stepdad legally adopted me, and his family has Scottish heritage, and that was kind of my doorway into discovering what the bagpipes were. I had never heard of them really much before outside of the parade setting, and I didn't know anything about them, and they really intrigued me, and I just wanted to know more and to figure out how they worked. So I became obsessed, and the rest is truly history. They just took over, and I went really hard with them. I traveled all over the world competing, and then, of course, the pandemic happened, gigs were canceled, I started posting on social media, and that is where I met Mia.
Very similar life stories with very different instruments.
Yeah, right, exactly. Tell us more about that actual meeting via viral videos, if you were. I mean, is it as simple as that, that one of you stumbled on the other in terms of what you had been posting? I mean, are we talking about that kind of crossing of paths, if you will?
It is pretty much as simple as that. You know, how the story goes is the Wellerman sea shanty was going viral on social media, and you know, our friend Nathan Evans is the one that kind of spearheaded that, and so I did a duet on social media with his original video. I added a bunch of violins to it. Our friend Colin Vance added a bunch of his Irish instrumentation to it.
And then I was following Colin. I was such a huge fan of him at the time, being another Celtic instrumentalist. And Nathan Evans, the original singer, is Scottish. And so I was like, oh, this needs bagpipes back in it. It needs that Scottish edge again. And that video also went viral. And I tagged Mia. She found me, followed me, and I followed her right back. And we just instantly became mega fans of each other. And we started our journey of duetting each other's videos and supporting each other in that way on social media.
But then the really interesting part, and this is what's so exciting about our Milwaukee show in particular, is because that show is on St. Patrick's Day. And St. Patrick's Day is a really special day for me and Ali, because two St. Patrick's Days ago, Allie had a gig in Boston where I was living at the time. And so she messaged me and said, hey, do you want to meet up and make some content together? And obviously I said yes. And so we actually met up for the first time in person in my apartment in Boston. We made a bunch of videos together, which like kind of launched our tour and us as a duo. And so then we were doing some like one-off shows together, guesting on friends' shows. Allie was a guest at one of my shows. And there was this unmistakable like energy between us that we don't have with anyone else. And so that's when we realized we really should have something special here. And so then the next St. Patrick's Day, Allie and I released our first song together, which is Shipping Up to Boston. It was a cover, and that was a year ago. And then now we're coming up on the third St. Patrick's Day, which is us completing our fourth tour together. And so it's a really special date for us.
I guess. Wonderful.
I mean, I didn't even realize this until right now. We're kind of like looking at each other like, wow, this is so exciting.
Yeah,
I guess that is, St. Patrick's Day is like a pivotal point every year for us as a duo.
Yeah.
It's so exciting
like
to be. It's like our anniversary, yeah.
Which is very fitting.
One of the things I was going to ask you about was exactly when you first met face-to-face for the first time, because of course, one can have a very vivid and vibrant virtual relationship, if you will, but there's something about actually being in the same room that's not exactly the same thing. And I could imagine a scenario where the two of you felt very compatible in this kind of virtual realm, but it must have been, in a sense, been an immense relief to actually get together in person and find that that chemistry was just as powerful, if not more so.
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy. It's always weird meeting somebody who you've only seen in a rectangle before. And Mia and I also, we had never video called. We had never had like a live conversation like that before. So I just showed up at her apartment. And fortunately, she let me in. But it was really nice. Before we even started working together, we went out and we got brunch at a really cute cafe. And we bonded. Yeah. And then we went and immediately got to work. And we had like this really... it was so fluid. Just you recorded, I recorded, we put things together. We just knew how to be in the videos. We fit together in the videos. Everything looked great. And it was so easy. I've never been able to film six videos and record six videos in a day before and have it just be so smooth. And it wasn't exhausting either. It was just like
energizing.
It was energizing. Yeah, that's the thing about it.
And that's how we knew we had something special. Because again, we collaborate with a lot of people, and we love all of our friends who we collaborate with. But between the two of us, because we're so similar, like it flows really naturally, and that's how this has been able to work so smoothly for the last year.
Mm, wonderful. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Mia X Alley. That's violinist Mia Asano. She plays the electric violin primarily these days, and Allie Crowley Duncan, billed as Allie the Piper, and this duo will be presenting a St. Patrick's Day concert on March 17th at the Vivarium in Milwaukee. And we are talking with them about their collaboration, which began actually during the darkest days of the COVID pandemic. And they are now touring and performing together extensively. Mia Asano, tell us the difference between playing classical violin. I almost said normal violin. I don't think I should probably phrase it that way. But, I mean, let's say the standard traditional violin versus the electric violin. Are they essentially identical instruments played identically? I mean, obviously, you're playing music that's very different from Mozart and Haydn or whatever. But in terms of technique and what you have to do as a violinist, are there a lot of differences between the standard acoustic violin versus the electric violin you play now?
There are a lot of differences. So I still play both regularly. You know, my first love was obviously classical music and then Celtic fiddle. So I play my acoustic violin every day as well as my electric. The main difference is, first of all, the acoustic violin has four strings. My electric violin, like I have like seven different electric violins, but my main one that you've seen probably, it has seven strings. Mm. So it actually has extended range, so it can play even lower than a cello, actually. So that's how I'm able, like Allie and I play Game of Thrones together, and that's how I'm able to play the cello parts for that.
Wow.
So that's the biggest difference. My electric, this one also, it props up on me using like a special device. So it actually like kind of straps onto me. So I don't need to use my chin and my neck to hold it down, which is really helpful. That's why, you know, Allie and I do all these dance moves. I'm headbanging. Allie's backbending. Like, we're able to do these moves, and a large part of that is because I don't rely on my chin to hold my violin down. So it really has opened up not only my musical capabilities but also my physical ones. It is a lot heavier, though, and it's a solid-bodied instrument. So my acoustic violin has natural resonance. It doesn't need to be plugged in order to be heard. The electric violin needs to be plugged into a guitar amp. But what that means is I can use electric guitar pedals, so it can sound like anything I want. And then that's something that's translated over to the bagpipes as well. So now Allie's also running through electric guitar pedals, and it's elevated our performance even more, and it's a really cool show as a result of that.
Wow. Very good. So Allie, one of the things that is so extraordinary is the way you are taking bagpipes into a musical direction that most of us just can't even fathom. So do you remember at what point it occurred to you that this instrument that we think of so often in very, you know, traditional terms is an instrument that could be utilized in rock music and in all kinds of other things? I mean, when and how and why did that even occur to you to use the bagpipes in this kind of unconventional way?
Well, the bagpipes, for starters, became my sole instrument. Like, you know, when you pick up your instrument, even though I love all of the ones that I play and all of the music that I do, nothing speaks to me, even singing, nothing feels more connected to me than playing the pipes. And it's where I feel like I can express myself the most, and like the music just comes out of me when I'm playing them. And so I've always been a fan of things like rock and metal and like different fusion styles, and I've always wanted to be able to perform that way. Like, I grew up wanting to be a rock star, but I play the bagpipes. So I think about 16 years old, and I was in a play at my local theater, and I had a role, and I played bagpipes. It was a comedy play, dinner theater style, and I got to collaborate with some of the other musicians that were part of the show. And I was like, hey, do you want to make a quick arrangement of Crazy Train by Ozzy Osbourne? And they were so in. So it was fiddle, acoustic guitar, and bagpipes, and we played Crazy Train. The play was called Finnegan's Wake, so I was supposed to be the bagpiper at the funeral, but it was just supposed to be lighthearted and funny. So I played Crazy Train. And everybody lost their minds. Like, the reaction and the response to it was like nothing I've ever had before, and I had so much fun with it. And that was my very first time kind of seeing the bagpipes in that way. There have been bagpipers in the past who've done rock and metal, like Bon Scott from AC/DC. There's a band called the Red Hot Chili Pipers, of course, the Dropkick Murphys. So it's, you know, kind of been done before, but in those settings, it's always a bagpipe playing a bagpipe tune in a rock and roll setting. What I've really experimented with over the pandemic is playing the bagpipes like they're an electric guitar, and writing my solos and writing my content around the way I would picture an electric guitar in that setting. And that has been such a huge task for me. It's been such a fun, like, project mentally. And it's similar to what Mia is doing. She's playing shreddy guitar solos on a violin, and I'm trying to do the same on the bagpipe. And that's where I feel like what I'm doing is different than what I've seen before.
Do I remember correctly that that bagpipes, in a sense, are limited in the tones that they can play? I mean, that sometimes when we hear, or typically when we hear bagpipes play perhaps a familiar melody, there might actually have to be a note or two that in fact are, I don't know, a half step lower or a half step high, but because we don't have the full chromatic scale available on the bagpipes. Am I remembering that correctly? And if with the bagpipes you play, is that also the case? And does that make a difference in terms of what songs you choose to play and how you play them?
You're entirely correct. The bagpipes in their natural form have 9 notes, 11 or 12 if you're creative. And we're kind of stuck in one key. So when I started doing a lot of this, I had to start getting extra creative. So I actually made my own bagpipe chanters that could play in other keys. So once I start playing, I am kind of locked in the key that I'm playing, but I can switch back and forth. So we have one medley that we do during the show where in the middle of the medley, I switch from one key to another, and it's so fun. And so that's kind of one way that I've done it. And then I worked with a bagpipe company Sorry, I dropped the phone.
It's okay.
It has a magnetic thing on the back, and I was too confident in it. Anyway, I worked with a bagpipe company to create that and mass produce it so other people could do that as well. But during our show, I play four different bagpipe chanters so that I'm able to play in four different keys. Actually, five different keys in total. And so that's huge for the bagpipes because, I mean, before bagpipes couldn't even play in any concert pitch. So it's really evolved a lot since the days where I was just playing as a solo competitive bagpiper.
Hmm. Yeah, but a lot of people don't realize how much work she's putting in to like actually be able to do that, you know, because you just come to the show and if you don't know anything about bagpipes, it's like, oh yeah, she's just playing. But I've watched her put so much time and effort, like literally carving her chanters during her rehearsals and like, you know, putting so much effort into being able to like do what she does. And it's really amazing.
Wow. To just kind of widen the palette of possibilities. Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because otherwise those of us sitting in the audience would take that entirely for granted. And it's something that we should appreciate and understand. Mia Asano, you know, you said that you started out classical and you still love classical and so on. How much carryover or crossover do you find between the kind of playing that you do now versus that other kind of playing? I mean, does that feel like it's on a whole different planet and very much a completely different thing, or does it feel tightly, closely related?
Well, so part of the reason I wanted to pursue music in college, like rather than just moving to LA and trying to be a musician, is I wanted to become like a really well-rounded musician. And that's what Berklee allowed me to do. Like I studied with a different professor every semester intentionally so I could learn all these different styles of music.
Wow.
So, you know, I'd done the classical thing for a long time. And then I was studying with like R&B violinists, jazz violinists, and flamenco violinists one semester. Like I was trying to just absorb every type of genre of music. And the thing that I learned from doing that is every technique can help inform other techniques. And part of being a well-rounded musician is being able to kind of be a chameleon and go into all these different genres of music and learn the nuances of them. But then the overarching thing that I'm so grateful for is my classical training, because it gave me this elevated level of technique that I wouldn't have had otherwise. Like I started studying classical music really intensely in high school with a teacher in the Colorado Symphony, and he working with him made me such a better player, and I was able to use those techniques in all the stuff that I do. So even when we're doing like you know, rock or pop or fiddle, I'm throwing in like all of these techniques from all these different genres I've studied, and I'm really grateful that I did that, because it gave me a bigger respect for music, and just the diversity of music. And you know, violin is not just a classical instrument, it's actually far reaching into other cultures as well. So I don't want to be like, I think it's important to be open-minded to all the different things the violin's capable of. And we even show that by playing a classical piece of music in the show. It's by Vivaldi, but we play it with a rock band.
Ah.
And so it's really special to be able to play that every night.
Fantastic. Allie, I want to give you just a moment to talk about something you made passing reference to, and that is the fact that once upon a time you devoted a great deal of time and attention to engaging in bagpipe competition. Can you just give our listeners an idea of what that world is like and what these bagpipe competitions are like? I mean, and when one is competing, in what way are you being judged?
So bagpipe competition, the whole world is so intense. A lot of people, you can find them anywhere if you go to a Scottish or Highland Games, and you'll be able to see competitors out there, but it runs so much deeper than that. I used to travel all over the entire globe to work with the best of the best instructors, because we're really spaced out. The community is, it feels big to me, but I know it's small. And so I flew out to BC to work with people, Scotland to work with people. I had an instructor who lived in California for a long time, and it was just anybody I could get my hands on, essentially, just to learn from the masters. And the competitive world is so cutthroat and so intense. There aren't a lot of women in the competitive scene, and so very often I was one of the only young women, especially, competing. And so it was a little isolating at times, but I really dedicated myself to it because I loved it so much. I loved being able to learn so much about the culture. And there are different genres, of course, that you'll play within the competitive world. The two main ones are light music and then great music called Kilmore. And that's kind of the ancient music, the classical music of the bagpipes is what we call it. And then light music is dance tunes, specifically for dancers like reels and jigs. And so I would compete in all of those, but a typical competition day would be I get up really early. I play for my drummer friends so that they can compete. I do my solo competition, which was usually four or five different events. And in the higher level grades, I would go to invitational competitions as well, like some of the North American championships. I've competed over in the World Championships in Scotland as well. I actually was part of a youth bagpipe band that won the World Championships when I was 16.
Wow.
And so I really, really loved the competition world. I loved the team player kind of aspect when you are with your other fellow competitors, helping each other out and things like that. And it's a long day, but I actually went to two proms directly after a bagpipe competition. So I was very, very, very dedicated.
Wow.
But I traveled all over the world to do it. And a lot of that still phases into what I do. So I play some of my old competition music in the show as well, but with a rock band.
Wow.
And so it feels kind of compatible with what Mia's doing and what she said about her classical training. It's all very much tied in, even though stylistically what I do now is very different.
Yeah. And by the way, bagpipes obviously make a lot of sound. I mean, it's a huge, big, brilliant sound that they make. Are you amplified when you are performing? I mean, electronically amplified?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we learned very quickly that the drummer is way louder than I am.
Wow.
our drummer is a metal drummer, and our guitarist is a fusion guitarist, and then we have an amplified electric violin. But the bagpipes are a beautiful solo acoustic instrument, but especially in the venues that we're playing in, you might be able to hear me right at the front, in the front row, if I wasn't amplified, but nobody in the back would get anything. So as Mia mentioned earlier, I'm running through guitar effects pedals now, and
It's okay.
I'm running through guitar effects pedals, and I'm kind of doing some similar things to what Mia and our guitarists are doing to kind of make the sound feel really blended. And that's been a very, very fun and challenging experience, just trying to figure out how to mic the bagpipe.
Mm.
I feel like we've gotten to a really good place.
Yeah. Wow. So let's finish by hearing exactly the kind of program that you're presenting on March 17th. And of course, it being St. Patrick's Day, I'm guessing that maybe the mix might include a bit of traditional stuff. But otherwise, for somebody going to your performance on March 17th, what can they expect to experience?
So we have a little something for everyone. It's a show you can bring the whole family to. We keep it family friendly. We have everything from video game, nerdy, TV, movie theme music. We have a bunch of our original music, and then we have Celtic music, like a lot of Celtic music, but that we do both together and separately. And then we're doing metal, rock, just about every genre of music. There's even like a moment where the boys are playing jazz. So there's truly something for everyone. And we really, put a big focus on playing some of our original tunes as well, because that's such an important part of who we are. And, our album, Mia X Ally, The Viral Hits, is all covers, and we play the whole album, but we also want there to be stuff that we've written as well. So it's a good balance of everything.
Wow. Very good. Well, this is all so exciting, and we want to make sure people mark their calendars accordingly for this performance coming up March 17th, 8 p.m. at the Vivarium. That's 1818 North Farwell. And you can Google Vivarium to find information on how to purchase your tickets. And otherwise, I know that the two of you also have a really beautiful website that has all kinds of information, but I don't remember the website address.
It is MiaXAlley.com.
Mia worked really hard on it.
Go check it out and send me praise.
It's a fine, fine website. It's exciting. So
thank
very
you.
Good.
Thank you so
I'm
much.
So glad we got this opportunity to connect, and wish you very, very great success in this upcoming performance and all the other touring that you're doing. MiaXAlley, Mia Asano and Ally the Piper, thank you for being my morning show guest. It was great to meet you today.
Thank you so much for having us. See you on St. Patrick's Day.
This is Mia X Alley's wonderful cover of the Lynyrd Skynyrd hit Free Bird. And a reminder once again that Mia X Alley will be performing this coming Sunday, that's St. Patrick's Day, 8 p.m. at the Vivarium in Milwaukee at 1818 North Farwell. My thanks to Mia Asano and Ali the Piper for being my guests on the morning show here on WGTD. Before we get to part two of today's morning show, we want to remind you that the morning show can be heard not only as a broadcast Monday through Friday, but as a podcast 7 days a week. That is, when you subscribe to the morning show podcast, you can hear a different morning show 7 days a week. And on the Saturday and Sunday podcast editions of the morning show, you're often treated to morning show interviews from 10, 15, even 20 years ago. To subscribe, be sure that you look for the proper title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Stay with us. Part two of today's program is coming up in just a moment. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Over the years, I had the pleasure on three different occasions of speaking with chef and cookbook author Raghavan Iyer. Sadly, Raghavan Iyer passed away about a year ago after a valiant battle with cancer. He passed away just a couple of days before I was scheduled to interview him yet again about his most recent book. The following morning show interview was recorded back in 2016. On one previous occasion, I had the pleasure of speaking with Raghavan Iyer about one of his previous books. He is a master chef and author of several different cookbooks, including 660 Curries. And he has written for such publications as Cooking Light, Eating Well, Weight Watchers magazine. He happens to be an addict. His addiction is potatoes. And that is the subject of his latest book, published by Workman, called Smashed, Mashed, Boiled, and Baked, and Fried Too, A Celebration of Potatoes in 75 Irresistible Recipes. Raghavan Iyer, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Greg. And this is one of those times when I can say I'm proud to be an addict.
Exactly. Before we talk about kind of the genesis of the book specifically, I want you to talk about just how long potatoes have been such a central part of your life and a source of such passion. It sounds like they were served extensively in your home growing up in Mumbai.
Yes, very much so. I would say ever since I was a child, you know, my earliest memories have always been about potatoes. And you know, also being the youngest child, my mother would always, you know, would get preferential treatment, and she would always say, what do I want for, you know, a meal, whether it's breakfast, lunch, or dinner? And I would always say potato, and I think after a while, she just stopped asking. It's like, why bother? It's going to be the same answer. So it's something that has always stuck with me over the years, and so I think when the opportunity came to do a book on potatoes, you know, it was a dream come true, so it's a passion that is 55 years old for sure.
Tell our listeners about the meal you enjoyed at a Turkish restaurant, I think maybe with a friend. which was really kind of the direct impetus for this book being written.
Yes, this was actually my friend and my editor, Suzanne Rafer, with Workman Publishing. We had, this is my third book with Suzanne, sixth in totality, but I remember she had taken me to a Turkish restaurant for dinner, and she had ordered potatoes, which came as a side dish, and I said, gee, Suzanne, how about a book on potatoes? And she goes, sold. It was a quick conversation, and we and that was it. And then next morning, I got a call from my agent, and then I put together a 2-page proposal for the book, and they went back and forth, and I got a contract to do a book on potatoes. But that is, you know, one of the things that to me was so important is the international nature of potatoes. You know, there's a reason why, Greg, this is the fourth largest crop in the world, because it is so versatile, it is so pervasive, and it is extremely accessible even to the common person. It's a cheap vegetable. It's also nutritionally solid. So from a standpoint of being able to, you know, have been embraced by the entire world, I felt I needed to do justice to a vegetable like that.
You give us a historical overview of the potato, and one thing I would love for you to explain to our listeners is, although we can trace the potato way, way back to the Andean culture, you tell us it's really not until the Incas that the potato, in a sense, take center stage. I think in your words, its full potential is unleashed or something. What did the Incas figure out about the potato?
They figured out how to actually cultivate it in ways that were much more conducive to larger crops and different varieties that go well. And they were able to use fairly sophisticated agricultural tools to come up with ways that they could make the potato survive these different shifts of climate, you know, within short time periods. And so I think, to me, they were masters at doing that. And then, of course, you know, from there, it just sort of blossomed into the world. And And that's one of the reasons why to this day in South America, I think they are just there alone because of the soil conditions. They're able to cultivate over 3,000 varieties of potatoes. And so that to me is truly the epicenter of potatoes.
You tell us in the book that there are actually 5,000 or more varieties of potatoes all around the world, and yet we can categorize them fairly simply in two directions, flowery and waxy. And this is something I never knew till I picked up your book, although then I sort of rewound in my mind and realized, oh, yeah, that's right. I think I see exactly what he's talking about there. Explain why it's important to have that distinction in mind when one, for instance, is shopping for potatoes.
Because I think, you know, the starch content of a potato determines what the cooking methods are ideal for those. And so when you think about the floury or the starchy potatoes, and you think about the russets and you think about, you know, the white potatoes that usually fall under that category, high in starch, low in moisture. And I think because of that, those varieties of potatoes lend themselves well for, you know, mashing and for baking and for deep frying because of the low moisture content. On the other end of the spectrum, when you look at the other variety, the waxy potatoes, or people call them boilers, red potatoes are very common. Fingerlings fall under that category as well. These potatoes have high moisture and low starch, and so because of that, they lend themselves well for boiling. And if you want to pan fry them and you want to keep the shape intact, they're very cohesive because of that. So they're beautiful for that. So they're not very good interchangeably. So, you know, you can't, you know, take a red potato, for instance, and fry them. You know, you're not going to get the same results as you would get with a starchy potato. So the type of potato makes a big determination of, you know, what cooking methods you can apply to those.
You also point out that although often they get in sort of included, that in fact we have to be careful to know that, sweet potato is actually no relative to the potato at all. I had not realized that.
Yeah, the potatoes, for instance, they come from the same family as the nightshade variety of plants, you know, tomatoes, eggplant, to name some of, you know, its siblings. But the sweet potato actually come from the morning glory family. And those, you know, unlike regular potatoes, sweet potato leaves, for instance, are very edible. And they're incredibly sweet, and they're delicious, even if you just stir-fry them. If you have, you know, access to sweet potato leaves, they are very, very good in stir-fries because of its inherent sweetness. But unlike those, you know, you cannot do the same with the potato greens because, first of all, you know, when the potato are harvested, especially towards the end of summer, early fall, the leaves are always dried, you know, on the ground before you yank them out, unless you're working with new potatoes, which are actually harvested early spring when the leaves are still green, and that's when you yank them out and then you eat the new potatoes. But that's really the big difference between the two.
Mm. Your book is full of what are called tater tips, all kinds of, you know, sort of bite-sized items of information, including mm-hmm. some great advice on how to properly choose a potato and also how to mm-hmm. properly store a potato. The one little interesting bit of information was your admonition that we should not store potatoes in the refrigerator. Tell us what happens if you do that.
Yeah, because potatoes, you know, the starch of the potato gets converted to sugars in the refrigerator. So you should never store your potatoes in the refrigerator unless, you know, you want to make, let's we talk about, you know, making French fries. So if you want to make potatoes that you don't want to deep fry, but you want to bake them in the oven instead, at that time, I would say you're much better off than storing that potato in the refrigerator because then you're letting your starch convert to sugar. And so when you're baking it, then, you know, it becomes nice and brown and crispy. That's what you're looking for. So that's the only time you would. But otherwise, I would say never store your potatoes in the refrigerator. Cool, dark spot, you know, in your pantry is the perfect spot for that. And then, you know, you replenish your stock often and you have the right potato. But if you're privy to actually, if you're living close to a farm, for instance, and you can get fresh dug potatoes with the mud still around it, store it that way in your pantry. And then that way, you know, as and when it lasts you throughout the winter and if it's nice and cool. And then you scrub them and you've got, you know, fresh potatoes at your beck and call. So.
Fantastic. We need to mention that there are 75 wonderful recipes in this book divided into six different chapters, all the way from munchies, tidbits and finger foods, all the way to dessert. And one doesn't often think of potatoes with dessert. I want to mention also the fact that people might pick up your book in a bookstore, take a look at the lengthy recipes and jump to the conclusion that these are complicated recipes, difficult to prepare. And it's probably really important for people to understand that these recipes are lengthy because they're detailed, not because they're complicated. And that's a really important difference.
Thank you so much for mentioning that. Yes, as a cooking teacher of 25 years, you know, I mean, I've always said my role as a teacher is to explain, you know, techniques, and, you know, there's a reason why we do certain things. And so when they're reading the steps, for instance, they get the impression that I'm in the kitchen with them as they're cooking. So it tells them what to look for, what the end result should be, what's the aroma, what's the color change. And so the explanations are detailed because it's a teaching tool. But from the standpoint of the recipe itself, all these recipes are extremely simple to execute. Some of them have, you know, many of them, in fact, have 10 ingredients or less. And so so simplicity of executing is very, very high. But the detailness and the length of the recipe comes from the explanations that you mentioned, which I feel is important.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that they are there. Let's take a couple minutes to talk about a couple of the most intriguing recipes. I want to start with one that I cannot wait to prepare myself because I've really fallen in love with chorizo. And so you have a recipe for chorizo stuffed hash browns. And I think this is a recipe that comes from Mexico.
And, you know, of course, morning favorites. You know, who doesn't love a really good hash brown? And I think, you know, when you think about taking the shredded potatoes, and the way it's stuffed is, you know, you have this layer of shredded potatoes, and then I have the chorizo, which is sort of the sandwich layer, and then on top of it, you know, I put the second layer of potato. And oftentimes, the potatoes themselves, the shreds, I mix it up with a little bit of egg in there, so it binds it together beautifully well. And so you get this, you know, almost like a potato sandwich, for lack of a better description, with the chorizo in between, and pan-fry both sides, and sometimes I'll throw in fresh spinach in there, you know, to give it some color and texture and further nutritional value to that as well. And you've got this breakfast complexity, you know, that's one skillet meal, I think. And that's a beautiful, beautiful dish to consume in the morning.
Very good. Why don't I play fair here and give you a chance to highlight a recipe that you think is especially noteworthy?
You know, I am, when you give me potatoes, that's noteworthy, but when you tell me these are fried, I sort of get weak in the knees. So I love, and it's a favorite of mine. You know, who doesn't love a good tater tot, you know? And so I have homemade tater tots, which are cheesy tater tots with fresh tarragon. And it's truly one of those recipes that I, you know, tested and retested about half a dozen times. Not because the recipe wouldn't work the first time, because I loved it so much the first time that I kept doing it again and again. Mm. And it's...
Well, that's how you achieve perfection. Well, let's remind our listeners of the title of the book, Smashed, Mashed, Boiled, and Baked, and Fried to a Celebration of Potatoes in 75 Irresistible Recipes, published by Workman. Raghavan Iyer, it's been great to talk with you, and thank you for this wonderful, wonderful book.
Thank you so much, Greg, and it's my pleasure, and hope you and your listeners have a great holiday.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye. Indian chef and cookbook author Raghavan Iyer passed away last year after a valiant battle with cancer. He's responsible for an array of wonderful cookbooks, and it has been my pleasure to interview him on several different occasions. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, best-selling author Tiffany Jewell, best known for books intended for younger readers. Her most recent is called Everything I Learned About Racism, I Learned in School. She recounts in this book what she encountered as a student in the public schools of Syracuse, New York. And Tiffany Jewell was actually biracial and was, for the most part, identified and categorized as Caucasian. And because of that, she says that she experienced a fair amount of privilege. And it was actually from that interesting perspective that she noticed the way that some students were relegated to the sidelines or in other ways mistreated because of race. That is the inspiration for this very intriguing book. Also tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be previewing the next production of The Lakeside Players, The 39 Steps. We'll talk to the director of the production, Stephen Matner. On Wednesday, we'll talk theater with Herschel Kruger and several Carthage theater students about the play On the Verge by Eric Overmeyer, which opens this coming weekend as well. On Thursday, an exciting day for The Morning Show, the first opportunity for us to welcome to the program Kaylin Palomares, who is on the staff of Hawthorne Hollow. She is stepping into the considerable legacy of Nan Calvert and will be helping to coordinate monthly environmental programs for the morning show. This first time out, she'll be talking with a colleague from Hawthorne Hollow, Laura Smith, about a maple sugaring. And on Friday, another big day for the morning show as we welcome to the program for the first time the relatively new Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, Dr. Lynn.